Hey, welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us today. And we're going to be have a full-packed show. Again, we're following the money with emphasis on federal pay, federal jobs, and the benefits and the threats to them that are posed by a variety of things. My guests this morning are Steve Losey and Sean Riley from the Federal Times. We've been talked about this before, but the situation seems to become more dire every week. Gents, you with us?
Here. How are you?
Hey, good. Thanks for having us. Listen, I was away last week in sunny California covering the Federal Dispute Resolution Conference. It was in Palm Desert, California, and someone had to do it, and I volunteered to do it so that you younger fellows wouldn't have to. So,
get some sun?
I did get some sun. Wonderful place. And, you know, it's one of those things, if you're a taxpayer, you hear about a couple of thousand federal workers out in the desert in Palm Springs, Palm Desert, and you think, what a boondoggle. But, A, it was 116 degrees, and out there they do the reverse of us on the East Coast. Here we say it's 96, but it feels like 100 because of the heat index. They out there say it's 116, but it feels like 104 because it's a dry heat. But nevertheless, it can kill you. And the rooms were, the convention rate were $99 a day, so a very good place to take a vacation if you can get that sort of cut. But ran into some wonderful people, some old friends, and some made some new friends, feds. But this is really kind of the cream of the crop, and it was good to recharge the batteries. When last we talked 2 weeks ago, the buyouts were starting to trickle in, and it looked like some places might be doing it. There was much speculation, and boy, the bottom has fallen out, hasn't it?
It sure does seem that way. Just in the last couple of weeks, last 2 weeks, we've gotten news from education about them offering buyouts, Commerce Department, the GAO just got their first wave of buyouts approved on Monday, and the Air Force announced a not just buyouts and early outs, but a 90-day hiring freeze. And now these buyouts and early outs, they range in size. You know, the Air Force is looking to cut about 4,000 civilian positions, and about half of those would be eligible for buyouts and early outs. And at the GAO, you know, smaller agencies like the GAO, we're talking, you know, about 56 positions likely eligible for buyouts. So the size, the scope of these buyouts and early outs varies widely, but the trend is obvious. Agencies, more and more, as they gear up for what is nearly certain to be several years of tight budgets, they're battening down the hatches, Mike. They're looking to cut costs any way they can, and one way they're doing that is through the workforce levels.
Well, I was talking with Tom Timmon and Amy Morris this morning on their show, the Federal Drive, and then we were thinking about how many, a lot of people, when they think of buyouts, they're still locked in the 1990s, the Clinton era buyouts, when 200 and something, the president decided he wanted to downsize the government by a specific figure. It was something like 276,400 people. It was very precise, and the idea was to bring the government down to the levels of the what it was in employment when John F. Kennedy was president, and that was sort of the goal. And the buyouts started in the Defense Department, and then they went to other agencies, but they were kind of broad-based, if you will. The newest round of buyouts seemed to be much more targeted, and you mentioned GAO, specifically 56 people, and it seems to me I read somewhere while I was on the trip that one agency, and I want to say Federal Trade Commission, maybe FCC, but one agency said, we're going to do something different. We're going to kind of right size, and that is we're going to change things, but it's not to cut the staffing levels so much as it is to change their skills balance.
That's correct. And, you know, when you talk about changing the skills balance, the agency that comes immediately to mind for me is education. Now, talking to education, most agencies who are offering buyouts, they're saying it's a budget issue. Education says they're in something of a different situation. They've been working on a workforce restructuring plan for a couple of years now, and they are basically, as they looked at the kind of jobs, the people they had, the kind of jobs they had, they realized, you know, some of these jobs we don't really do anymore. And some of the positions we have people at, say, GS 14s or 15s, and they said, you know, maybe we can get it done with a perhaps a GS-11 or a 12 or a 13. So they're basically kind of trying to take a hard look at themselves and who they're hiring. That's why their buyouts and early outs, they're hoping about 340 people are going to retire or separate through that offer, and most of those are going to be targeted at senior-level people, people GS-12 and higher. So it's a rough situation that agencies are in right now, but there is a silver lining in that it's prompting a lot of soul-searching at federal agencies. What do we do, and what do we need to do, and what maybe can we do without?
Well, Tom Timmon made the point this morning that if a private company decided to right-size and get rid of older management types, the higher salary people, they might run into some legal problems with Uncle Sam, but I assume this doesn't apply in this case?
Not as far as I know. I mean, that's a good question, and it's one I hadn't thought about, but for now it seems agencies feel that they're kind of on solid legal ground by trying to reduce their more expensive staff.
Yeah, my thought was that since they are offering buyouts, it would be presumably a voluntary thing. I mean, they may call you in the room and say, make you an offer you can't refuse, although the Godfather, but more often than not, it's going to be $25,000. Looking at the buyout for a minute, this $25,000 figure was established in the 1990s when a dollar went a little bit further than it does now. It was aimed at blue-collar men in the Defense Department, a lot of the wage-grade people, but it was considered enough in those days. You could take a $25,000 buyout, and depending on your retirement system, it would be reduced by various deductions. But people were looking at taking home $16,000 to $18,000 after all of the deductions, and that was enough to get a car. Not the case nowadays. Have you heard any speculation about making buyouts more generous?
I have not, and I don't think that's in the cards, really, considering the financial state the federal government is in, and to be frank, the opinion that has really taken hold on the right that federal employees are already overly compensated and overly paid. If someone were to come out and say, you know, maybe we should pay them more to leave, I could see a lot of Republicans saying, we're paying people to leave now. $25,000 is already too much. We shouldn't be paying these people to leave. And that could, you know, prompt some people to say, well, instead we should be laying off people. So, which is a kind of a roundabout way of answering your question that, no, I don't see that $25,000 increasing anytime soon.
Well, you know, Bill Bransford, we noticed at the FDR conference last week in California, the year before, he and I and Jessica Clement of the Federal Managers Association had done a legislative outlook workshop, and I remember distinctly Bill Bransford walked in with a copy of USA Today in his hand, and there was a front page story which said that federal workers on average are paid more than the average American worker. And he said, this is trouble. And we sort of, you know, moaned and groaned. Then came the stories that not only are federal workers paid more than the average American, but federal workers in the same jobs are paid more than the average American doing the same job in the private sector. And the latest, of course, was the one using some selected statistics from some agencies that said you're more likely to drop dead at work, to die at your desk, than you are to be fired. And that's set up, as you mentioned, a certain tone, and we need to take a break here, but I'd like to talk to you about that, the mood in the country and the mood in the Congress, when we come back here after a break on WFED 1500 AM.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
Listen next week for a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Conversation with Authors, exploring national security, power, and leadership in the 21st century. What is smart power? How do 21st century challenges demand a reshaping and redefining of global leadership? And how best can national security leaders transform the intelligence enterprise to meet today's needs? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with Professor Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
And now Ask the CIO, brought to you by Vion Corporation.
Vivek Kundra is the outgoing federal CIO. He says there's one lesson he's learned over his two-year tenure that stands out the most.
Because, you know, there isn't a laser beam focus on what needs to be done. And they're usually, you know, this is something Jeff did really well, too, around the performance agenda, was instead of having 300,000 different objectives, like focus. So focus coupled with ruthless execution actually delivers results. And I think that's probably the most powerful lesson I've learned.
Whether your organization calls it cloud, utility computing, managed services, or capacity services, at the core is the rapid provisioning of information technology infrastructure. At Vion Corporation, they pioneered capacity services 10 years ago. Vion was awarded the first and currently holds the largest federal government capacity services contract. They provide government IT owners an agile financial vehicle for meeting mission-critical IT needs. Vion and Hitachi Data Systems have been delivering IT solutions to the government for over 31 years. Visit Vion.com to learn more.
Schneider Electric has a proven 100-year-long record of supporting federal agencies to help you meet your responsibilities to mandates, missions, and taxpayers by combining the expertise of brands you know and trust, like Square D, APC, and Pelco, to make your energy safe, reliable, efficient, productive, and green. When it comes to power, process and machine, IT room, building, and security management, Schneider Electric's your energy expert and green partner for a sustainable and prosperous future. Visit Schneider-Electric.us. The challenge is to accomplish your mission even when you're under cyber attack. The cyber analysts at Kinetic North America, along with their proactive cyber solutions, can protect your critical information. With mission assurance solutions, insider threat identification, and advanced persistent threat detection, they have the technical and cyber capabilities to keep you ahead of threats. Learn more at kinetic-na.com/get-secure. That's kinetic-na.com/get-secure. When it's critical, it's Kinetic North America.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest and partner, John Frieden, where we'll talk about the law of blogging. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the law firm of Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service firm serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area. If you'd like to know more about the firm, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Steve Losey and Sean Riley. They are senior writers for the Federal Times newspaper and sort of covering the government like a waterfront. So, gents, we were talking about the mood in the country, which I guess you could say was kicked off by this series in USA Today a year ago this month. About the fact that the numbers that had showed that federal workers on average are paid considerably more than people in the private sector are paid. That was followed up by one which said that federal workers are paid more for doing the same jobs than people in the private sector, again, with some exceptions. And the most recent one, and I'm not sure if this was USA Today or not, but it was a story which took several federal agencies, looked at the mortality in them and the quit rate and the firing rate, and the conclusion was that you're much more likely to die at your desk than to be given a pink slip and told to leave. And obviously this plus the election revolution of last year, the new Congress coming in, this seems to have had a change, a darker tone for the federal workforce among the American people.
Yeah, that's definitely right. You know, just yesterday, I mean, you can tell it's the presidential campaign is in full swing because the hits on federal employees are coming fast and furious. Just yesterday, Mitt Romney was in New Hampshire, and he was at a campaign stop, and he made a comment about there being too many federal employees and they're paid too much. I believe over the weekend, Michelle Bachmann, who's also running for president, she was citing some figures that that showed the growth in federal employees paid more than $170,000 at the Transportation Department, and she was playing a little fast and loose with the numbers. It is true, as she said, that the number of transportation employees making, you know, more than $170,000 has gone from one in 2007 to a few thousand now. There has been a large growth, but she was kind of trying to pin it on Barack Obama when a large chunk of that happened under the watch of George W. Bush. So anyway, there's a lot of swipes being taken at federal workers, and it's just going to get worse as 2012 progresses.
Well, people would think, because of the beats we cover, me for Federal News Radio, you guys for the Federal Times, that we are sort of natural apologists for the federal workforce and they can do no wrong. And I really don't think that is the case. We look at them with a pretty jaundiced eye. But one of the things that people fail to mention when they're talking, particularly about average salaries, because averages, as we all know, are, I think, the Mississippi River on average is 7 feet deep. So what good does that do you?
Yes.
You know, if you're crossing or going to ground a barge. But the federal workforce is so very different. It's so much more professional and administrative than the private sector workforce. You know, Uncle Sam has more nuclear physicists than he has hairdressers. There are more rocket scientists and NASA astronauts than there are people who cook hamburgers. The government is a very different thing, and I saw some statistics the other day, may have been in the Federal Times, but they were talking about the high percentage of federal workers who have a college degree. It is considerably higher than the average in the public. The number with advanced degrees, graduate degrees, seems to me 20% higher than in the private sector. And just was 9/11, which was, we all know, changed the world, changed us, changed the government. But with this new emphasis on Homeland Security and the people they brought in as experts, this has pushed the salaries up almost in a natural cause of things.
That's correct. You know, there's in a lot of the reports you cite, sometimes there's a grain of truth, but sometimes it doesn't tell the whole story. And what you say is correct. The federal workforce is very highly educated, is very skilled. You know, you look at the old photos from, say, World War II of just row after row of federal clerks. I mean, you know, dozens and dozens of federal clerks at their desk typing or filing. That doesn't exist anymore. That's not the federal workforce we have today. Today's federal workforce is, you know, does a lot of stuff with computers. They're very skilled. They have bachelor's and master's degrees. And so that's going to drive up the salaries on the one hand. And in the private sector, the private sector's suffered a massive loss in earning power when the manufacturing sector in this country has collapsed. There's an awful lot of jobs out there that are service industry jobs that don't pay very well and that have no similar equivalent in the federal workforce. So that's going to skew it. And there's also the fact that a lot of federal employees, not all federal employees are in Washington, of course, but there are several hundred thousand in Washington. It's a very high cost of living area. Federal employees are going to be concentrated in high cost of living areas. That's also going to drive up the cost. Now, there is probably something to the criticisms that on the lower end of the pay scale, the less skilled workers, there probably is federal employees are probably paid more than they would earn in the private sector. But conversely, higher level employees, engineers, say, doctors, probably earn less in the federal government than they would in the private sector. So there's some truth there, but we don't really have a good solid picture on exactly what the pay differential is between private sector and federal employees. And we need to, the federal government needs to really do a better job looking at that kind of thing.
I used to work with a reporter, Larry Feinberg, to put a name to it, who was an expert with statistics. And he, as far as I could tell, he didn't have any agenda. He would just, you'd give him a pile of numbers, and he would go through them, and he'd come up with these fascinating stories that I wouldn't have been capable of producing, and they just let the chips fall where they may. There was a story not long ago, a couple of months ago, front page, and it said, I believe there were 11,000 federal workers who made more in salary than the governors of their states. And, again, I'm sure that's true. But it didn't point out that in some states, governors are not paid very well on purpose. They get some very nice benefits from limos to airplanes, but their salary's not high. And I know when Bill Clinton came to Washington, the average federal worker here at that time made more than he did as governor of Arkansas. But they didn't have access to state police cars or helicopters or whatnot. But those numbers, as it turned out, the numbers in that news story cited, the 11,000 people, many of them were doctors, were federal doctors, and you would expect them to be high paid as they are in the private sector. And I don't know anybody who shops for a doctor by finding out the one that has the least income.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I remember that survey, and I believe there were some states where the governors earned something like $50,000,
mm-hmm.
which is, of course, not peanuts. But when you, as you say, you have doctors are going to earn a good bit because they incur so much in their they have to go to school for so long. They incur so much student loan debt. They're very skilled people. They or at least they should be very skilled people. I would hope so. So yeah, there's in some of these there's a grain of truth. But sometimes you have to dig deeper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can interject, I worked in a Deep South state for many years, and there were many state employees who actually made more than the governor did. So as Steve indicated, I mean, it's an interesting bit, it's an interesting data point, but I don't really know how much, in the long run, how much significance it actually has.
Well, again, you can take these numbers and make any point you want with them if you exclude some things or forget some things. And I know that I'm always shocked, guess I shouldn't be, to find out that the highest paid state official in many states is the football coach of the state university. It makes 4 times what the governor does, 10 times what the governor does.
100 times.
Yeah, that's right, and it's amazing. Well, that is all interesting. That's not going to go away, but that certainly contributes to the mood in the country and the political mood. And we wanted to get to the super committee in Congress. But first, I know you guys have been tracking this postal situation very closely, and it's absolutely fascinating. They're talking about getting rid of 220,000 people, 38% of their workforce, 120 maybe by buyouts and that sort of thing, and another 100,000 by attrition. And they're also talking about maybe pulling out of the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program and running their own plan. So what's going on there with the second biggest agency in government?
Well, it's kind of a head-scratcher, Mike. This really came out of the blue last week. You know, the Postal Service, as you know, has been focused this year on getting Congress to give it a break on the retiree health care prepayment that's due next month, about $5.5 billion, trying to get Congress to let it go from 6 day to 5 day delivery, and then also trying to get lawmakers to agree to a refund of what the Postal Service believes are tens of billions of dollars of overpayments into the civil service retirement system and federal employee retirement system. And a lot of people are kind of puzzled by the abruptness by which this new plan came out, where, as you noted, they want to basically reduce their career workforce by about 220,000 by 2015, pull out of the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program, as well as the Federal Employee Retirement System.
Listen, let me break right there, because I want to ask you about that in some detail. Because
there's no better way to study the world
before
best
I knew it. And we'll have to take a break. We'll be right back here on 1500 AM.
There's no better way to study the world's best golf swings than to watch them side by side on the range. Move down the line from Arnold Palmer to Fred Couples to Phil Mickelson, and you notice not just the differences, but the similarities. like their wonderful balance, rhythm, and timing. And if you look closely as they leave, you'll notice something else they have in common. The same timepiece, a Rolex Day-Date. Available in 18-karat white or yellow gold or platinum, the Day-Date is put through 15 days and nights of the most grueling testing before it ever leaves Geneva. That ensures that, like these great golfers, it will perform as well in the real world as it does in practice. To see a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
Here's Dr. Ron Ross, senior computer scientist and information security researcher, NIST, on the Federal Executive Forum on Cybersecurity, sponsored by HP Enterprise Services.
That's where the real vision for the future kicks in. We've got to be able to have the systems and the infrastructure churn at a rate that even though the systems have been penetrated, the adversary's time on target is so limited that they can't do any damage.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective, and that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help governments secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. Learn more. Visit hp.com/go/cybersecurity.
I work to help our nation, and my work makes an impact. I help my government and our allies keep citizens safe from terrorism and cyber warfare. I work for ManTech International Corporation.
Around the world and at home, ManTech employees work side by side with our troops and government to protect our homeland. We have more than 10,000 professionals doing rewarding work every day. If you're an IT professional, security expert, intelligence analyst, or engineer, apply today at ManTech.com/careers.
Coming to the Reagan Building, the first vendor-neutral predictive analytics conference for the government. Predictive Analytics World, September 12th and 13th. PAWGov.com. Featuring keynotes from Congressman Darrell Issa and Chairman of the Recovery Board Earl Devaney, along with case studies from government agencies. This September at the Reagan Building. Learn more at PAWGov.com. That's PAWGOV.com.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Growing healthy in community gardens. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Community gardening may help people grow a healthier lifestyle. Researchers saw that in survey data from Denver residents in 2006 and 2007. Jill Litt of the Colorado School of Public Health says community gardeners ate better.
About 25% of people who did not garden met standard health advice, which is about 5 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. About 35% of home gardeners and 50% of community gardeners met these recommendations.
Litt says the social aspect of community gardening also seemed to improve physical activity and appreciation of people's neighborhoods. The study in the American Journal of Public Health was supported by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey. I'm talking with Steve Losey and Sean Riley from the Federal Times, and we were discussing the Postal Service situation. There have been changes proposed earlier, going from a six-day-a-week delivery to five-day, cutting back a huge number of postal offices. But then, in the last week or so, this decision, they hope to eliminate 220,000 postal jobs, which I guess would take it from the second-largest federal agency agency to maybe the 9th or 10th. And then this really incredible proposal to pull U.S. Postal Service out of the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. And you also, you mentioned the retirement plan as well.
Yeah, they want to take out, they basically want to go ahead and create their own retirement system, which would mean pulling out over a million active and retired postal employees out of both the civil service retirement system and the federal employees retirement system.
Well, I got an email from Walton Francis. He is the guy that writes the Washington Consumer Checkbook Guide to Federal Health Plans. He was a longtime high official at Health and Human Services. He served on a number of commissions for health care reform for the nation as well as the feds. And this is what he said about this thing. He says the USPS proposal to pull out of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program and run their own health plan is on its face nonsensical and shows either their inability to understand health insurance management or a ploy to solve their retiree pre-funding problem or a ploy to reduce employee and retiree benefits or all three. The stated reasons like the, quote, unique demographic and program needs, end quote, of the USPS not being met by 200 federal employee health plans, a half a dozen of which are run by postal unions and designed to meet postal employee needs, are absurd. So I take it he's not a big fan of this kind of thing.
It would seem so.
Yeah.
And I think there are an awful lot of questions the Postal Service has yet to address about what it wants to do. Basically, it's put out about 10 pages of what it calls discussion drafts. Where it outlines what its plans are. I've talked to someone at the Postal Service who told me that in regard to creating its own health plan, that this would be competitively bid. Obviously, it would have to be nationwide. And I think we can presume that, yeah, it is intended to save money, so it would probably not be as generous to employees as the current system is.
Well, you know, I just had a off-the-top-of-my-head thought here, which is always dangerous on live radio. But the Postal Service, as I recall, in some years, probably because of the Government Accountability Office, has a higher disability or retirement rate than the U.S. Marine Corps. And that's not as maybe as silly as it sounds because, you know, these people are out there. Dog bites are a tremendous problem. They're a joke. They're made for the funny papers, but they're a tremendous problem. People are always falling. People are injured as more and more letter carriers are in cars and in vehicles. The police will tell you that the average policeman, they're more likely to be involved in a traffic accident than in kind of a shooting thing. But the Postal Service is a fairly dangerous place to work, and I would think if it went on its own as a self-insurer or hooked up with some other thing, that you're comparing that population and their accident rate and maybe their health rate, they might not get a very good deal.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. I mean, I didn't realize it was higher than the U.S. Marine Corps but they're just, in regard to their disability rate, but certainly there are a lot of repetitive motion injuries, you know, from working these sorting machines, the dog bites, in terms of what the potential cost of coverage would be, I think you're right. There's a pretty good chance it would be higher than it would be, say, for the normal federal population, employee population.
There was a rather small federal agency some years back that decided it could do a better job of going it alone, and it was not one where you don't have major injuries or accidents. It was one of the elite banking institutions. But they went out and decided to have their own health insurance program, and within a couple of years, they were begging, they were knocking at the door of OPM to be let back in because they couldn't get anywhere the deal, the bargaining power they had when you're talking about 3 million federal workers, 2 million federal workers, 3 million and 5 million total with the retirees. So that's not, what do you think's the motivation? I mean, you think they really think they can do better?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, there are a lot, as I said, there are tons of questions still surrounding this, and I think we can say safely that there is zero chance that any of this will be enacted by Congress at least this year, and probably if it would face pretty steep odds next year. A couple of different theories out there. One is you can take the Postal Service at face value. They said in one of these discussion drafts that they were looking at their financial projection for the next couple of years, and it became clear that their situation is worse than they expected and that they need to take more drastic action than they had originally thought. That said, there's little, if any, likelihood that this will be, that Congress is going to deal with this anytime soon. So you could see it also as just an effort to kind of shake things up. You know, as I mentioned before, the Postal Service has been pleading with Congress all year long, and actually before this year as well, to give it some relief on retiree health care prepayments, you know, delivery operations, et cetera, and they've gotten nowhere. I mean, there are a couple of different bills that have been introduced at this point. The one thing they all have in common is that they are still stuck in committee. No one has moved. So you could see this as an attempt to kind of wake lawmakers up to the undeniable seriousness of the Postal Service financial situation. You could also see this as sort of a long-term strategy. They know that the postal leaders know they're not going to get anything immediately, but if you look at this as a long-term effort, a long-term approach to unwinding some of the restrictions on layoffs that you have wrapped into union contracts, as well as higher costs and for retirement and the health care programs they might otherwise have to pay if they went it alone, you could see this as sort of the kickoff for a long-term campaign.
Jess, we've got another situation here. We have this the super committee. I don't know what the nickname for it is, but this is the one appointed by the leadership of the House and the Senate. It's bipartisan, bicameral. They're supposed to be like the BRAC Commission and come up with recommendations. Is it by Labor Day or shortly thereafter?
By Thanksgiving, I think this super
Thanksgiving,
committee,
that's right.
Yeah, November 23rd,
that's
I think,
right.
Is when they're supposed to report.
I remember the obvious turkey references, which were irresistible, but they're going to come up with these list of recommendations, presumably by that date or close to it. And then in theory, it's an up or down thing. The Congress will vote on it. And the idea is it's less painful for members of Congress because they can say they went with a consensus. And while they may have hurt some of their constituents, it's good for the country. That's in the theory about how it's supposed to work. Given the mood in the public and particularly in the Congress, in this Congress, and we're talking about the Republican majority in the House, there's really a very anti-government mood, the likes of which I can't recall. And, you know, when you look at a situation like the Postal Service and you look at some other agencies and they say, if this doesn't happen, we're going to have to shut down. We're going to go out of business. And I get the impression that some of these politicians, that's exactly what they would like, is for the government to fail completely.
There's a lot of people who think that, who see what's going on in Congress and have come to that conclusion, yeah.
And I think also, I mean, we're talking about this to some extent in the abstract. You know, the one thing I think we all learned during the 95-96 shutdowns is that there are actually a lot of, you know, specific government services that a lot of people, including conservatives, folks who vote conservative, actually like and don't want to be deprived of. And so once it gets down to actual impact on government services, I think you're perhaps likely to see some people's attitudes change.
Well, as a class, I would say that members of Congress are literally among the major high flyers in the United States. That is, they spend an awful lot of time traveling and traveling by air. And I thought it was interesting that when they left town to go on their most recent vacation and, quote, shut down the FAA, they shut down a very small portion of the FAA, 4,000 people, along with thousands of contractors. But these are people who are not involved in flights because these members of Congress wanted to go on vacation and go places. So this was a non-essential part to them, but shut down the FAA, shut down Social Security, and shut down the IRS, and you have some problems.
Yeah, and I think it was interesting with the FAA shutdown. As you said, this was not, you know, planes kept flying, air traffic controllers stayed on duty, but Congress took a pounding for letting this happen in the first place, where you had, you know, almost 4,000 FAA employees furloughed without pay. In most cases through no fault of their own, and even though they were on recess, and the initial prediction was this would not be resolved until after the return from recess after Labor Day, they managed to work out a deal that got this settled within 2 weeks, I think. I think it was, for some members, I think a chastening experience, and it may not be, you know, maybe one they're not anxious to repeat.
Well, I would think, too, that a lot of this, there were 60,000 to 70,000 contractors who were idled by this, and for them, there is probably no question of getting back pay. I mean, they've taken a 50% pay cut for a 13-day period there.
I would presume, unless they have exceptionally generous employers, that's the case.
Yeah, that's the way it works in the private sector. And I think that was it more than the FAA people itself. But I think it also, the way it was handled, they just left town, left this simmering, and then to fix it up, a member of the Senate who happens to live right across the river from the Capitol came in, and in about 6 seconds they pounded a gavel and went through this. And I think people who were following that, fortunately for Congress, most people people probably weren't following it. But I think those who watched the process left a pretty bad taste in their mouth about the way the legislative branch is running itself.
Well, the fact that, you know, in this economy that you would be throwing tens of thousands of people out of work, essentially over, you know, the congressional equivalent of a food fight. I mean, these were not huge issues that were holding up, you know, extension of this funding legislation. I think you're right. It did leave a bad taste in people's mouth, and that's why it got settled as quickly as it did.
I need to take a break here, but I want to break out the crystal ball when we get back and see what's coming up. Be right back here on WFED 1500 AM.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Could switching to GEICO really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Can you find anything on the internet? Well, I'm sure you can, but don't take my word for it. Just ask this talking dog who can only say I love you. Roll the clip. One more time, talking dog.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com to see how much you could save. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The FBI has released its first ever mobile application. It's designed to help locate missing children. The FBI Child ID app lets parents store photos and vital information about their kids, so it's immediately available to pass on to authorities in the event a child goes missing. It also lets parents email photos directly to law enforcement. And it includes tips on what to do in the first hours after a child disappears. The iPhone version is out now. The FBI says other devices will be supported soon.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology. Information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
And now Ask the CIO, brought to you by Vion Corporation.
Stephen Van Roekel is the new federal chief information officer. He says his experience has shown him how change can happen.
What I really saw at the FCC is that this notion of reimagining government in the context of the pace of innovation of private industry can be done in government. And it can be done in a way that actually saves money, saves resources. We were in lockstep with Vivek's team here on data center consolidation, our cloud-first policy, on using tools like TechStack.
Sound familiar?
Where's my data stored? Who owns it? How many duplicates exist? How much file data is unused? How are we going to pay for all of it?
Vion Corporation's capacity services is the answer. Your organization needs a trusted advisor with the right technical tools and the right financial expertise to solve big storage problems for good. For over 31 years, Vion Corporation and Hitachi Data Systems have been planning and preparing to solve big data problems for the government at the exabyte level. Visit Vion.com to learn more. That's Vion.com.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to federalnewsradio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Federal employees, With a two-year pay freeze, rising health care costs, and potential changes to retirement annuity calculations on the way, recent financial events may have you concerned. First Command Financial Advisors understand the federal benefits system and can help you maximize the value of your benefits. Visit federal.firstcommand.com for an office near you and to request a complimentary financial consultation. That's federal.firstcommand.com.
First Command Financial Planning, Inc. Member SIPC and FINRA. First Command is not affiliated with or endorsed by the U.S. government.
Wake up and drive in with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris on the Federal Drive. It's your early line on the day ahead from your trusted advisors. Tom and Amy give you a full view of the issues. Find out what your colleagues in other agencies are up to and what policy and congressional developments mean to you. The Federal Drive with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris. Weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Mike Causey, welcome back to your turn. We're in the final round here. I'm talking with Steve Losey, Sean Riley from the Federal Times. Had a really good discussion about what's going on in the government, from buyouts to the Postal Service thinking about or hoping to pull out of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, among other things, which is a shocker to a lot of people. We were discussing the Congressional Commission, the bipartisan commission that is just due to report back on or about Thanksgiving, with a list of recommendations that presumably the House and the Senate will look at and either agree to or not, but it will be an up or down vote. The potential is to streamline it, get some things done toward the end of the year, and make some progress in reducing the debt and just improving the economic condition of the country. And it's important for people to remember that this commission, this congressional commission, is looking at they're looking at everything. This is not aimed solely at federal employees or even the federal government. I mean, there could be a proposal in there to eliminate the tax break for home mortgages. We just don't know. But what's your from reporting on this, I know you guys have followed it closely, what is possible for federal workers, postal people, and retirees to come out of this commission?
Well, from talking to people in the federal community, there's a lot of concerns that the super committee could revive some of these proposals that the House and President Obama were looking at very closely, that ultimately got stripped out of the final debt ceiling deal. You know, before, if you remember last month, Obama and House Speaker Boehner, they were zeroing in on a pretty sizable deficit reduction plan until the whole thing went up in flames. But part of that deal would have switched federal employees from their high three to a high five for determining the size of their pensions. It would have used the so-called chain CPI to calculate COLAs for federal military pensions, which would have lowered annual adjustments by about a quarter of a percentage point, and most distasteful at all for federal employees, it would have drastically increased the amount that federal employees contribute to their pensions, which would have felt like a pay cut.
Now, yeah. Okay. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. And did they also were they also looking at a different formula for health premiums?
You know, that was something that's been discussed many times over the last couple of months. I did not hear. I don't recall hearing that was going to be specifically part of the Obama-Boehner deal. So that's possible. It's certainly possible, but I wouldn't say certain.
Well, looking back on the three you've named here, this changing the amount of the contributions to the retirement system, the tip-off for me when I read that and then saw a comment, was how well-versed Vice President Biden was on the subject. And again, as we've said before, he's a smart guy. You're not expecting that this would be a surprise, but it's surprising that someone at that level would have gone down in the weeds enough to understand the complexities of this. And he was quoting numbers and saying how this would happen, what would happen in the savings, and that made me think this was probably very high on the agenda.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's certainly disheartening to federal unions that the White House was so open to considering these kinds of changes. I was talking to John Gage, the president of the American Federation of Government Employees, and he was the most despondent I've ever seen last month, when this was looking like it was going to be very much a part of a deal. So, yeah, but, you know, these things are in the weeds, but that's where this deficit problem, that's where it lives, in the weeds.
And that would be a tremendous savings to the government if federal workers had to pay more for their own retirement. And the other thing you mentioned, the chained CPI, which sounds like almost a rock band, but in fact that's a formulaic change that would reduce future cost of living adjustments for federal retirees, military retirees, and presumably people under Social Security by about a quarter of a point over what they would be under the current system. Doesn't sound like much, but over time with compounding, that would be less than expected annuities and benefits for retirees and a real windfall for the government. I mean, that's the kind of thing that they would look at because it's complex, it's hard to explain, it's hard to understand. Therefore, you might get away with it politically.
Yeah. You know, there is one silver lining for federal employees on this super committee. House Speaker Pelosi appointed, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, appointed Chris Van Hollen, a lawmaker from Maryland who counts in his constituency thousands of federal employees. He's real near the district. And Chris Van Hollen, along with Steny Hoyer, was one of the people who were fighting the proposal to have federal employees pay a vast amount more for their federal pension. So Chris Van Hollen's presence on the super committee means that federal employees will have at least some voice on this committee. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Van Hollen will have enough clout to completely take federal employees' stuff off the table, but he'll at least presumably be pulling for them to try to minimize the pain for federal employees.
Well, it's certainly good to have him in the room in these kinds of things because the way Congress has worked in the past, and I don't know about the animosity level of late, but the way it's worked in the past is you get somebody like Van Hollen with a large federal employee constituency who also knows a lot about the issues, and oftentimes people who are not up on this or maybe don't have many feds in their district, or maybe they do have a lot of them, will defer to him and they'll say, how bad is this? What's going to be the reaction? What can we live without this? So that having him on the panel is a plus. We don't know how much.
Yeah. And you know, I don't know if the super committee is going to look at this, but this sort of kind of harkens back to the postal conversation we were having a bit ago. One thing that I thought was interesting was that in the Postal Service's plan, they talk about for future employees having them future postal employees losing their defined benefit pension entirely, and they would only have a 401k-like plan, which would be separate from the thrift savings plan. Now, that's essentially what Senator Tom Coburn proposed back in, I believe it was the spring. So that proposal never really went anywhere, but now the Postal Service seems to be giving that new life. So, you know, Congress is out. No, it's too soon to say whether the Postal Service's revival of that proposal will give Coburn's plan new life, but it's something that we're going to have to start keeping an eye on to see whether this is a harbinger of things to come.
Well, and if you talk about having a revolving door government and a revolving door postal service where people put in a few years and then go elsewhere, that would certainly contribute to that, wouldn't it?
That's right.
Okay. Listen, I want to thank you guys for being with us this week. Very entertaining and educational. Learned an awful lot. And we're going to come back here next week again and discuss what's happening with the feds. And the one thing that interested me is the fact that this high three, high five, we've been sort of downplaying it, poo-pooing it as something that wasn't proposed and it wasn't a real threat to people. But suddenly it's back.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it ever really went away. I think its effect on federal employees would be less than, say, the very much increased contributions. But yeah, it is back. We should kind of keep an eye on this and see where it goes.
Well, and a lot of traffic we were getting to were from people who wanted to know when was it going to happen and would they have time to retire. That was sort of the driving force for them, and we kept saying it's not that big a deal and it's not imminent, but suddenly it is back on the radar scope, huh?
And that's something you keep hearing is what will the effect be if this is in fact enacted? Will it? I heard some discussion about this at a conference last month about whether this will prompt some folks, you know, older feds,
yes,
to finally take the plunge and get out.
All right, well, we got to pull the plug here, too. Thank you, Sean, and thank you, Steve. And we'll talk to you next week. And everybody have a good week. Buckle up and be safe.